Jesus Christ. So what I want to do today is just look at three things that this passage, I think, is bringing out to us about the mystery. Okay, the revelation of the mystery, that is the nature of what it is that's coming forth. The role of the church in making known the mystery, and the ripple effect of this mystery. The revelation of the mystery, the role of the church in making known the mystery, and the effect that knowing this mystery has on us. Okay, first, about it, the mystery itself. This Greek word muo, means to hide or conceal. Okay, and you know, it's kind of an onomatopoeia here. You have to close your lips to make the sound. And muo. You're acting out what you're saying. Okay, it's the same experience we get to say the word mute. It's to conceal. It's to cover up. And in the Hellenistic world, there were these cults. They were called mystery religions. And they were very big, folks. Oh, big stuff, mystery religions, big business. And they were called mystery religions because the uninitiated were unallowed to know the secrets. They were denied access to the sacred. They were denied knowledge until they went through elaborate initiatory rites. And our knowledge of these rites are sketchy because very crucial to this, to being in a mystery religion, was a vow of secrecy. Once you went through these rites, you couldn't talk about them. It was sacrilege. Okay, so we have a sketchy knowledge about them, but it seems like these rites all involved people coming to the point of death, people being brought somehow to the point of death and acting out a drama of some divinity in the cycle of life. But you couldn't talk about it, so it's hard to know what was going on. And going to this border of death brought you in contact with the divine, and through that you got cosmic life. And so it was quite Masonic, because it was very secret. And this was the mystery. It was a very technical word. That's what it meant. That's why it's a mystery. And in other areas of that ancient world, mystery was also a big word in philosophy. It was the same thing, the term mystery, not until after Plato. Plato didn't like this, but it developed to mean teachings that elevated the soul to give it union with the divine. And similarly, these secrets had a covering about them. They were secret. In Gnosticism as well, developing during that time, there was similar. Mysteries were these powerful secrets. Secret instruments which must not be betrayed, lest they lose their power. And you can see evidence of that even today with the remains, the residuals of Gnosticism, the Gnostic Gospels. You know, you can go into any hip bookstore and get some of these Gnostic Gospels to read. They're very big, you know, they're easy to find. And what do you find there? You find this attitude of secrecy about them. And don't be fooled, please, folks, by cheap imitations. These Gnostic Gospels come from a period of time much later than the Gospels in the Bible. If you want to find out about Jesus, these were written during the lifetimes of eyewitnesses, whereas the Gnostic Gospels come from a later time. But if you take a look at them, that's what you see, right? You open the Gospel of Thomas. It's the first thing that you read, the alleged Gospel of Thomas. These are the secret sayings of Jesus, right? Yeah. And what I want you to see is that it's a complete contrast, to the attitude of the apostles. And what do you see the apostles doing during this time, in the first century when they were preaching and when they were writing? It was throw open the windows, stand up and cheer. Proclaim it from the housetops. The message is plain and it's clear. And it is simple, but with almost incomprehensible profundity. Jesus Christ died on the cross. Trust in that, and you will connect with the divine. Put your trust in that, and you will have eternal life. Very different. And so what we see is a salvation where you don't have to go through a secret rite to obtain it, but one that comes to you. It's not about what you do. It's about what he did. And Christian baptism is this initiatory rite of the Christian faith, baptism. It's deliberately simple, in contradistinction to these mystery religion rites. Very simple process, very open. And you could see the great distinction if you were living in that world. You had the mystery religions where you had a very elaborate process to go through to be initiated. And you had Christianity with this, you know, water. Now, very interesting. Very interesting if you trace through history what happens after the apostles die. The Christian baptism, certainly under the influence of these mystery religions, became something very elaborate. In the era of the early church, as time went on, the centuries went on, Christian baptism became this incredibly elaborate process, and secret, too. So this word is loaded. Okay, I'll give you a little bit of taste of how loaded this word is when it's being used here in the first century, in the 60s AD. I mean, it's hardly used by the church fathers, and my guess is for this very reason. Because it had, not just in philosophy and in Gnosticism, mystery religions, but also in magic. It was another big word that had a technical meaning. So it was very easy for this to be misunderstood. I think that's the reason why church fathers don't use it. But Paul uses it quite a bit here. We see it throughout this letter. And he uses it in a number of places, but in a different way. Always, it seems to me, in contradiction to the Gnosticism and the mystery religions in this way. It's not a truth concealed, but a truth revealed. The concealing revealing has to do with time. It's a story. It's a truth that history has just been waiting to see unfold. The mystery that the prophet Daniel foresaw but could not understand. The mystery of Christ and the church. That God himself would come into life as a man, give that life to purchase a people, to create the church. So here we come, folks. Now we're coming to the end of this letter called Ephesians. I've preached 22 sermons on this letter, and Vito, I think, one or two as well. And if you think back on where we come from, it might seem like a dizzying array of topics that we've covered. But if you think back, I think you can see that nearly all could be included under the heading of Christ making unity. Okay, you recall the first half of the book, how Paul begins with the marriage of piety and philosophy that so impressed Justin Martyr, how that's done in Christianity, the marriage of piety and philosophy. And he shows how Christ unites all things in heaven and on earth, in predestination and human responsibility, in Jews and Gentiles coming together. And as he's done this, Christ has broken down, remember, that pervading wall of hostility, which is so high and so prevalent. And by bringing near those who were far away, and this unity is achieved through giving us, you know, a science fiction worldview that we're in the heavenlies, you know, by giving us the incomparable power of the resurrection to change things, and by grasping the unknowable love of God. And then beginning in chapter 4, he starts applying these truths. He applies the work of Christ, showing what this means. First, in the church, how unity is the fundamental, how unity requires diversity, how maturity comes through speaking the truth in love to one another, and how it also comes through having an obsession with forgiveness. And then out of church, in the workplace, in the home place, Paul's charge is to live out among non-believers, promoting godlike sex and godlike drunkenness. How unity in marriage comes from recognizing that gender matters in a mutual surrender. Unity in parenting comes from keeping hold of two handles. Unity at work comes from seeing God as your boss, and that there is finally there's a conspirator out to get you through disunity, and you need to take measures against him. Now we come to the end of the book. And in Paul's final words, we see one of these thrusts of unity one last time, the union of all peoples through Christ. So he talked about uniting Jews and Gentiles. He talked about Christians living out among those who disagree with them in Ephesians 5. And now, implied in the way that he speaks of his relationship to these churches, we may discern here the attitude and the role that we must play as a church in this unity, the role of the church in making known the mystery. So let me look at that briefly now, the second point. See, Paul expects them to want to know. That's what we see in his words here, don't we? You see how Paul is sending this letter by Tychicus in verse 21? Why is he sending it? He says, so that they can know not only how he is, but everything about him. That is Paul. And I'd like to point out to you that Paul is saying that he wants them to know what he's doing, how he has been making known this mystery. In other words, implied in this relationship, even though I would argue that the addressees are churches to which he has never been, or if he has been there, it's been for a short visit, he expects them to care very much about what he's doing. He expects them to be involved in it. He expects them to be praying for it regularly. So note what this expectation means. They are involved in this work of making known the gospel. It's not just Paul's work. He expects them to be intimately involved and to be caring about how this is going forth, how this mystery is being made known. And that's important because after all this talk about the implications of this theology for their lives, both in the church and in the workplace and the home, I mean, it could have given the impression that what this mystery was about is us. The point is to have a good marriage. The point is to have well-behaved kids. The point is to have a peaceful job. The point is to have a good life. But because of what he says in chapter 1 about bringing people together, because of what he says in chapter 5 about being out as light, he's demanding that the mystery's unfolding is more than our prosperity as a community or as individuals. And if your church or if your Christian life loses the element of making known the mystery of the gospel, then you have lost a third of what the church is, of what your Christian life is about. Then you're no longer taking the purposes of Jesus Christ as your purposes, no longer loving him with an undying love. Because you should get from this letter, and the way that Paul talks about this, the mystery of the gospel being made known in these days, is that you need to be strategizing, both as an individual and as a church, of how to let people know about Christ. So, we're going to have this outdoor service. We're waiting for absolutely final approval, but we have preliminary approval, including a permit number, for the Village Church on September 14th to conduct its worship service on the east side of the fountain in Washington Square Park. And I point out that it's going to be on the east side of the fountain so you can begin to think in your mind what it's going to feel like to go to our worship service, not here, indoors, but outdoors on the east side of the fountain of Washington Square Park. And I know some of you are thrilled to hear about this. I know that some of you just said, wow, this is great. Let's go out there. Let's sing. Let's play our music. Let's preach. Let's do what we do. I know that there might be some of you who are wondering, is this a good idea? Well, I don't know if it's a good idea. You might be wondering, is it going to work? Well, I don't know if it's going to work. But I'll tell you, Tony Lynn and I, you know this guy, we we brought up before. He has cleverly engineered it so that he's going to put this on for us and then leave. So he's running this, and he is putting this on, and but he's going to be with us for that Sunday. And we were sitting down talking. Tony is this year's director of outreach for our extensive outreach program. But we were sitting around, we were wondering, how do we make known this mystery in Greenwich Village? And to be realistic, we said, how could we, you know, what's one thing we could do this year? We're not going to try to be overly ambitious. There's one thing we could do to try to fulfill what Paul is talking about here as a local church. So Tony polled a bunch of people about, you know, ideas we could do, things we could do. And when this idea came forth of having one service in the park, we just thought, this fits the bill. We tried this, we thought about it earlier in the year, connection with the AIDS walk didn't work. But we thought this would fit the bill. So this is what we're trying to do. It's the first step to making known the word to a relatively unreached people group. You know, because part of this thrust should be to get the word to people who don't hear it. But the people who hear it, fine, you know, they can decide. But there are many who don't hear it. And it's true around the world, but it's also, in a small sense, true in our community. We want to make known this mystery to people who don't hear it. And because Greenwich Village is about coming out, right? We're going to be coming out that Sunday. Greenwich Village is also about going to Washington Square Park and making a statement. So we're also going to learn about what missionaries call contextualization. That is, if you want to make known the word in a new place, you need to become one of the people that you are speaking to. So we're going to learn about that, I'm sure. So we plan to make this service especially for your non-Christian friends and strangers that you meet. Hopefully, if we can get together, have invitations ahead of time for you. You can invite people to come hear music, open-air preaching, something of a novelty, to hand out treats for folks and literature, both sweet things together. We really just want to be a benefit to the park that day. You want to help out with this? See Tony Lynn. He doesn't even have to raise his hand now. He can use your help with that. Okay, so finally I want to talk about the effect of this mystery. And especially because in light of the blackout this week. You know, because this message took a man who is rotting in prison and made him into, how does he say it here? An ambassador in chains. An ambassador in chains. You know, Paul has made it clear throughout the letter that he's in jail. And he's been there a long time. You know? In fact, as of the writing of this letter, he's been in one prison or another, straight this time, since 57 A.D. This letter was written somewhere between 61 and 63 A.D. So for all that time, these 5 or 6 years, he's in his jail cell, and he now comes to a point where he can make a request for prayer. Okay, prayer request time. And he says, I want you to pray for me. Now, you know why you should make this gospel known? Because of what he asks for in prayer. What would Paul ask for? What do you think that he would ask for? You know, I'm in this cell, and I would like a little comfort for this trial that I'm going through. I'm in this cell. Pray for me. Please pray for me. I would like, you know, I'm doing this for God. I would like maybe a good meal once in a while. I am here in a prison for not doing anything wrong. And yet I'm here being treated as a criminal when I'm trying to do what's right. Would you pray for me? I have a little affirmation that I'm on the right track. Would you pray for me that I would have a little encouragement about what I'm doing? would you pray for me that I would, that this, would you pray about this thorn in my flesh? None of these things. None of these things does he ask for. No, his prayer is that when he speaks, he would be given boldness as he opens his mouth. That he would be fearless in speaking. He says it twice in this passage. Parousia, a state of boldness, confidence, courage, fearlessness before people. How could this be, folks? Things were not going well for Paul personally. He wasn't securing an apartment. He wasn't getting paid well. People hated him. He didn't see his own personal state advancing. But this mystery changed a rotting prisoner into an ambassador in chains. How? Because the story that unfolded in history encompassed him. Because if Christ was his righteousness, if Jesus in truth went to jail for Paul, then Paul's circumstantial jail was of little consequence. See what is happening in Paul? Because this gospel is not only his job, it was his sustenance. If Christ was his freedom, the chains on his ankles were paper. It would be like if somebody came up to you and said, you know, I like you. I'm giving you the ambassador's mansion in the center of Manhattan. Okay? You get the ambassador's mansion. Go ahead, move in. It's yours. But then when you got there, you found out that you had to take the garbage out as part of living there. Now, what would you say to that deal? Would you say, oh, that was a bad deal? You know, no, you would take one look at your current apartment and say, I am moving in. So I have to take out the garbage? Yeah. Okay. And if that's it, that is a terrific deal. I'm moving right in. So what? Who cares? I can take the garbage out of my ambassador's mansion. You see, that's just Paul's attitude toward his prison. I'm in prison, so what? If it furthers this message of real freedom, getting out to people, not a secret knowledge, but a wide open message, great. Don't bother God about my circumstances. Talk with him about making me bold to make known this mystery. Primarily care about how my words will benefit the hearers rather than concern about my trial. So, this is how Paul's chains became incorporated into the story of the mystery being revealed. Having that mansion in Christ, he became an ambassador in chains. And so what? His defense is his offense. When in jail, pray for boldness. In the midst of persecution, move forward. So what's your prison? You know, the blackout this week, it was helpful for me in getting me thinking about the role we could play as a family and as a church, too, in future trouble the next time around. But during this blackout, the blackout prison this week, how did you do? Was Paul here a contrast or a comparison? What about your normal prison? What circumstance do you have that you cannot overcome? If you apply the truth revealed here, the mystery of the gospel, it will unite things in heaven and on earth for you as well. If you take Christ as your freedom, your chains will be paper. The peace and love, he says of verse 23, it comes by faith. It comes with faith, he says, with meaning by means of that faith. Peace and love come alongside your faith. They come through believing. That's the mystery. It's a truth revealed that changes you. That's the incredible effect. That's why it's so important to have it be made known. Once you realize that in your own life. We began this examination of the mystery in Ephesians with Justin Martyr walking along the beach in Ephesus And someone, you know, some old guy with a beard, whose name we never learn, was equipped to speak to Justin about Christ and change a generation. That old man is you, if you can receive this mystery now revealed. Heed this letter, dear Village Church. It will make you a strong people, able to do what we are here to do, and having done all, to stand. And this concludes our cursory examination of the New Testament letter called Ephesians.
This table is also a manifestation of that mystery. Jesus Christ incarnate, his flesh and his blood broken and poured out for the forgiveness of sins, for the uniting of heaven and earth, for the uniting of his people here on earth. This table is not the table of the Village Church or the Presbyterian Church. This is the Lord's table. It's a family meal of Christians, and we invite all committed followers of Jesus Christ, those who are under the oversight of any church that preaches the gospel, to join us here at this table, a table for sinners, a table for those who are sick, to be made well by the brokenness of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Please rise and join me in the great thanksgiving, which can be found in your bulletin. The Lord be with you.
Also with you.
Lift up your heart.
Lift up the Lord.
Let us give thanks to the Lord our God. It is right to give him thanks and praise at all times and everywhere, our God, our Father, and our King, the Almighty Father, who rules us and who is sovereign over all things. We give you thanks, Heavenly Father, for being sovereign and for giving us this great mystery by which we are united to you, who are the author and the giver of all good things, the author and giver of life. We ask that you draw our hearts now to Jesus Christ, the mystery that is made known in him, that in him the sins of the world are taken away, that in him is peace. We give you thanks that you have given us this meal that joins us together with the church everywhere in all times and at all places. And we sing together now and lift up your name in praise to the glory of your name.